You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just imagine serving more than 4 years in prison for a crime you did not commit. Our next guest, Julie Baumer, does not have to imagine it. She lived it. Last month, after numerous failed attempts in previous legislatures, Michigan became the 32nd state to offer compensation to people who have been wrongfully convicted and exonerated. They're now eligible for $50,000 for every year they served in prison, plus other support services. For the next three Mondays, we'll feature people who are eligible for this new compensation. The first is Julie Baumer. We spoke recently at her attorney's office in Detroit about the effort to clear her name. Julie, let's start by talking about the chain of events that landed you in prison. You're exonerated now, but this chain of events that all began with what?
Well, in 2003, my sister gave birth to a little boy in whom she was unable to care for. With the blessing of my family, I decided to proceed with an in-family adoption. And Philip was born 2 weeks premature, if you will, by the induction of the medical staff through the use of Pitocin. Right after his birth, he was hospitalized in the neonatal intensive care unit, and it was from our understanding that he was just going to be lethargic or slow beginning, if you will, for whatever reasons. So when he was 5 weeks old, he stopped eating for me. So I called his pediatrician after about 12 hours of him not taking down a feeding. I asked her, what would you recommend that I do? Because his temperature doesn't seem to be off, and I, of course, had all these parenting books, and you're going through, you know, troubleshooting and whatnot. And so I wasn't really sure, you know, what was going on. I just knew that he wasn't keeping a feeding down. So she suggested that I take him into the ER room so that they could immediately do an IV to keep him hydrated, and then they would assess the situation from there. When I took him into the ER room, he was there for probably about 2 hours before they decided to transfer him to a children's hospital, and then it was 12 hours after that point that we were notified. The doctor on staff stated that there was a nurse that was doing daily checks and that the circumference of his head had grown alarmingly enough for them to do a CAT scan and MRI, and upon that they saw bleeding on the brain, and because I was the last person with Philip, I was, of course, the prime suspect of alleged child abuse, baby shaken syndrome.
What was that moment like when suddenly you realized that they were looking at you and thought you had hurt that baby?
It was surreal. It wasn't something that I've, of course, it didn't cross my mind. It didn't cross the mind of anybody in my family or whatnot. It was something that is this really happening? Or, you know, is there a way to get a second opinion?
And then you're charged, you wind up on trial, and you're found guilty. Take me to that moment when you heard that word guilty.
Well, when I heard the guilty verdict, again, that was a surreal moment. Is this really happening? How did we get to this point? It was devastating. I knew that it was going to be a collapse in my life, with a ripple effect going everywhere in every dynamic part of my life, personal and professional. Immediately, I just knew that I had to appeal it and go through the process of trying to prove my innocence.
What was your sentence?
Initially, the sentencing guidelines, if you will, were 1 to 4 years. However, the sentencing judge, he gave me the maximum, which was 10 to 15. Of course, I knew that worst case scenario would be the full 15 because I would never see a parole board and I could not show any remorse or guilt for something that I didn't do. I couldn't own up to something that I didn't do. So I pretty much was calling it the 15 years.
Tell us how you handled day-to-day life in prison. On one hand, you're hoping that an appeal will work, but on the other hand, you just said you kind of were resigned to the full 15.
Oh, that's a pretty big question because there's so many different degrees to it, if you will. But basically, you follow the rules and you try to be as cordial and as polite to everyone around you. And minus all of the chaos and the drama that's involved in or that goes on in an environment such as that, I tried to maintain the same schedule that I would outside, that I had outside. You know, I made sure that I had a daily job. And in the evenings, I would resort to reading or writing for a form of entertainment. And then, of course, I would just go go walk the track. I did a lot of walking just to pass the time.
Take us up to the point where the door opened to this exoneration that finally happened. How did that all come together?
In September of 2007, I was denied my appeal by the Michigan Supreme Court, and so I pretty much realized that I had exhausted the appeals on my end as far as I was able to do. Of course, I was indigent. I had been imprisoned now for 2 years going on three. I've always been religious, and I was born and raised Catholic, but of course I just started giving all the glory to God. Instead of asking him, why is this happening to me, I began my prayers with, how can I glorify you in this situation? And by December of 2007, I was contacted by a nun out of the Felician Sisters of here in Livonia, and she basically asked if there was any legal counsel that I might need, and of course I said yes. And so she knew of a professor at the Ave Maria School of Law. Currently, it's no longer in Michigan, but he and his class were willing to take me on as a class project. The students, of course, found merit in my case. They knew that they were in pretty deep. And so, ironically and through the grace of God, simultaneously that same year, the University of Michigan opened up their exclusive non-DNA Innocence Project. And so we were able to, with their assistance, and then assistance of counsel from out-of-state, Heather Kirkwood, who specializes in the defense for those accused of baby-shaken syndrome, if you will. She was the one that was able to bring in these world-renowned doctors who independently wrote these affidavits. After seeing these radiology CAT scans, it's very clear that this child did not suffer any form of abuse, but rather a form of childhood stroke, venous sinus thrombosis.
When did the moment happen when you heard the words exonerated and you're getting out?
Well, of course, I always claimed that from day one. I just didn't know when, but I knew it was going to happen. I did allow myself to have that much faith in the legal system where the miscarriages would be corrected, if you will. However, it was in early 2009 when I was informed that the judge would be overturning my conviction. We weren't sure if the state was going to re-pick up the case or whatnot, but for whatever reason, it took a few months for all of the paperwork to go through or however that falls and goes into play, but it wasn't until November of 2009 that I actually received a visit from Charles Lugosi, who was the professor originally on the case, and he said, they've overturned your conviction. They know that you're innocent. Unfortunately, at that point, I was informed that the state was going to retry me, so I wasn't exactly released from custody at that point. I had to wait about 2-3 weeks for a court hearing, if you will, and then it was at that court hearing where I was recharged. It was almost like a new arraignment. I was recharged, and then I had to bond myself out. I had family willing and waiting to do that, and then they put a tether on me, and I waited 10 more months for the second trial.
And what changed in the second trial?
A lot of things changed. I don't want to say that my initial trial attorney didn't have faith in me or my innocence. I think that a lot of things were above and beyond his knowledge, and he just didn't reach out for the proper resources that he should have. So, of course, in my second trial, instead of having one attorney, I had a plethora of attorneys, including students who were actively working for the Innocence Project. And like I said, these experts, you need experts, pro bono assistance. They independently read these medical records, and they all came to the same conclusion.
So you'd been out with a tether, but then you were found not guilty in that second trial,
right.
And now this thing was off your back at last. So after all that time, you were in prison for a total of how many years?
I was convicted in September of 2005, and I was released in December of 2009.
So these lost years of your life and earning power, wrongfully convicted, what were you given to help pick up your life as a free person again?
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. I was given the, you're not guilty, you're free to go.
And when you stop and realize that parolees in Michigan get help with things like housing and medical care and job placement, but here you are, exonerated after spending all those years in prison unjustly and not one iota of support.
Yeah, not no, absolutely, and you know, anything from even just a simple apology, you know, several times I've stated in different situations, and it's the best analogy that I can come up with is, you know, I was in my formative years, mid to late 20s, and I was trying to build my life and networking and just basically the foundation to get to a lifestyle that one would desire, and all of that was taken from me. And it was just given back to me in a bag, if you will, with missing pieces. So I was trying to put together this jigsaw puzzle, if you will, and you can just imagine the hell. You can just imagine.
So tell us a little about your life today. What are you working on? What are you doing? What have you been doing in terms maybe of education or retraining?
I'm currently working on my BA to finish schooling. Prior to my choice to return to school, for 4.5 years I was employed with a local parish, which I was gratefully employed for because it was a steady income. It was a good environment. And through that, I was able to rebuild my credit and purchase a home. And so I did that in 2013. However, we're in 2017, and I'm still behind on so many different levels, if you will. For somebody who's 40 years old, I'm very, very behind. If there was emotional and psychological support immediately upon release, medical support upon release, who knows, things could probably be a little different. But again, when you're, like I said, you're giving your life back and there's missing pieces, there was no manual to say how do you do this and how do you handle this and how you can predict this and whatnot. So you just take it on a day-to-day basis, no matter how cliche that sounds, but mm-hmm. that's all you could do.
The state's new law grants $50,000 per year for every year spent in prison and reentry services to exonerees like you. But it's all new, and at this point, you're not sure how you're going to proceed or when you're going to proceed to go after that. Let's say you do, and it all works out. You're able to prove that, yes, indeed, you were wrongfully convicted. What would you do with that money?
With that money, I think the only logical thing that I could do with it would be to invest it and allow it to grow and in some way give it back in some form or manner to the injustices that I personally experienced while being under the care of the Department of Corrections. You know, so many times did I see young women going through the revolving door process, if you will, and it's like, even though it's the Department of Corrections and I'm really not trying to, you know, impugn what they're trying to do in the overall sense, but in realistically from my aspect and from a lot of inmates' aspects, it's the Department of Housing. It's where society's rejects are sent. And so what I would like to do is try to implement some form of programs for those wrongfully convicted or otherwise where they can strive to better themselves and be the best versions of themselves while incarcerated and after incarceration.
I'm interested in how your nephew is today. And do you see him? And are you in contact with your sister?
My nephew, he was adopted out before I was even convicted. There's obvious other flaws in other areas of the system. During my second trial, I did make contact with the adoptive parents through my attorneys, hoping to build a bridge between the two families. But unfortunately, when the not guilty verdict was returned, the family turned cold on me, if you will, meaning that it was quite obvious that they didn't want to have any contact between the two families. So I don't know his present condition.
Julie, how are you doing in terms of forgiving the injustice that was done to you?
Well, because there was several factors in my case that I would have to believe that brought the guilty verdict originally, if you will, all I can say is that, you know, we're all humans and we're all subject to error. And, of course, you know, our criminal justice system, you know, it's like a machine, and it needs to be maintained to keep the wheels spinning. And if there's any form of kink in that maintenance of this machine, if you will, of course there's going to be errors, or there's going to be the results of wrongful convictions or injustices, if you will. So I would have to think that I can't say, oh, I forgive any one entity, but I do acknowledge that there is error. And it's just unfortunate that those who could have corrected this before it accelerated to the point that it could have, especially one of the doctors stating, I might have been wrong, but I don't want to go back into my other cases, and I have a practice, and I have a reputation, and I have a family, so if I was wrong about this one, how many more have I been wrong against? So I'm not going to change my testimony for the second trial. it's one's pride. And like I said, it's just not one particular entity. There was several, and it's just unfortunate that human error and the neglect of acknowledging that or owning up to it, if you will, results in what happened to me.
So when you were accused and went through the whole trial and you're found guilty, how did that affect your relationship with your family and with your friends?
Well, of course, this originated and stemmed from my younger sister having an addiction problem. Just growing up in the environment and the family that I did, we were always taught not to air your dirty laundry, if you will. So, of course, in my personal setting amongst my family and whatnot, everybody was on the up and up of what was actually happening in regards to the in-family adoption and how it came to be or whatnot. But in my professional life, I really didn't share a whole lot of the negative aspects or how things were transpiring. In fact, realistically, I almost lived a double life all the way up until the time of my conviction. At the time, I was actively involved in a local Kiwanis group, and I was the president at that time. And I remember the next day, had I not been convicted, I would have still carried on with a board meeting that had been scheduled a month before. And so I was just trying to really keep my life, and I really didn't expect a guilty verdict. So I just figured, okay, we'll move that out of the way and continue moving forward and, you know, just hope for the best.
And what about now? How are things now?
I would have to truthfully say that I wish that they were better, but realistically, after my incarceration, of course, I had full support from my family, but people in my professional and associate life, if you will, those who you associate with, they did contact my father and, you know, well, what's going on? We read about this in the paper, or, you know, what's the status of this or that? So I had heard that I had a lot of people inquiring about, you know, what's going on with Julie, but nobody actually contacted me directly. To be in prison, you're very isolated, and you have a lot of solitude time, if you will, and so you have a lot of time to reflect. And I guess the only thing that I came up with was to excuse their behavior or their lack of concern, if you will, was people handle situations differently. You know, if my office mate, who I had been an office mate with for 3 years, if all of a sudden he came to me and said, I'm dying of cancer and I have 3 months, how would I respond to that? How would I, you know, I mean, you know, you can mull it over in your head a million and one times, but, you know, it is what it is. And unfortunately, after I was exonerated, truthfully, I guess I was a little bitter because I did have some people that reached out, but it was like, well, where were you 3, 4, 5 years ago, you know, when I needed your support and your assistance and whatnot. So I just, I've maintained sort of that solitudeness, if you will, and right now I just focus on caring for my elderly father and providing a roof over our heads, and like I said, that's all I can do.
That was Julie Baumer. She served 4 years in prison for a crime she didn't commit. She is now eligible under a new Michigan law to receive $200,000 in compensation. Join us next Monday for the story of a Detroit man also set to receive compensation for his wrongful conviction. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.